Usually when we talk about the cloud, there's this this expectation of magic. We treat it like it's this ethereal, weightless thing just floating above us.
Right. Yeah, like it's just completely detached from reality.
Exactly. You upload a file, it vanishes into the ether, and you just sort of trust that it's safely suspended up there somewhere.
I mean, it's an incredibly comforting abstraction. We really like the idea that our data is just, everywhere and nowhere all at once because it feels entirely frictionless.
But then you actually look at the blueprints of how the internet functions, and suddenly that weightless ether just completely evaporates.
No, absolutely. It's not air at all.
No, we're looking at a landscape that is stubbornly, aggressively physical. I mean, we're talking about steel, concrete, massive cooling towers, and like fiber optic cables literally trenched under oceans.
It is the absolute definition of heavy industry. We've essentially disguised these massive real estate and logistics empires as thin air.
Well, welcome to the deep dive. Today we're unpacking a really fascinating set of source materials. It's a dense, highly practical blueprint based on a set of internal study notes covering AWS's global infrastructure.
Yeah, and it's quite a journey to go through.
It really is. Our mission for you today is to completely demystify this physical reality.
Yeah.
We're going to translate these dry technical architecture concepts into a vivid working mental map of how the internet's backbone actually operates under your feet.
These materials detail the architecture of the largest global cloud infrastructure on the planet. They laid out exactly how this massive physical machine is engineered for high availability, fault tolerance, and, performance for customers worldwide.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the ultimate irony of the cloud is that it isn't in the sky at all.
Not even a little bit.
Right. To really understand how your favorite streaming app doesn't crash during the Super Bowl, or how your bank keeps your transaction data secure, we have to start with the largest puzzle pieces on this global map, and those are called regions.
Yeah, so when you hear region in this context, you need to visualize a massive physical geographic territory somewhere in the world.
Like actual land borders.
Exactly. They have specific designations like US East 1 in Northern Virginia or US West 1 in Ireland. These are the macro level anchor points of the
Now,
entire system.
reading through the documentation, the thing that immediately jumped out to me is how fiercely isolated these regions are.
Oh, yeah, people get that wrong all the time.
Right. I think the default assumption most of us have is that if you drop a database into the cloud, it just automatically copies itself across the globe, so it's always safe.
I mean, that is easily one of the most dangerous misconceptions in cloud architecture. The documentation emphasizes this really heavily. Each region is fundamentally completely independent.
So it's not talking to the others automatically.
No, there is absolutely no data replication between regions unless you, as the architect, configure the system to do so.
So my user database sitting in the US East 1 region isn't secretly backing itself up in London just in case someone unplugs the wrong server rack.
Not even a single byte of it. And that by design isolation is crucial for security and performance. But it brings up the reality of how you actually go about choosing a region when you're building out a platform.
It's a complex decision tree, right?
Oh, yeah. Very complex.
Because I was originally thinking about this, like picking a physical location for a brick and mortar flagship store. Like, if the cloud is technically accessible from everywhere, why wouldn't I just look at the global menu of regions and drop all my infrastructure into whichever one happens to have the cheapest compute prices?
What's fascinating here is the major exam tip the notes highlight regarding that exact instinct. They explicitly mandate always consider compliance first when choosing a region.
Compliance, okay.
Yeah, compliance and data residency legally dictate where data can physically exist, and those rules must trump every other consideration.
So before we even bring the engineering team into the room to discuss network performance or like the finance team to discuss cost, we literally have to consult the lawyers.
You absolutely have to start with the legal team. I mean, if you're handling the healthcare records of European citizens or the financial data of a specific government, stringent laws often require that data to physically remain within those borders.
Ah.
Right? So if the law dictates the data cannot leave Europe, you deploy in a European region. The laws of physics take a back seat to the laws of the land.
That is a brilliant way to frame it. The laws of physics yield to the laws of the land.
Exactly.
So once the legal constraints are satisfied and we have a short list of compliant locations, I imagine the engineers finally get their say.
Yeah, that's where the second rule comes into play, which is latency.
Just how fast it is.
Pure proximity to your end users. We aren't just talking about a vague delay, we are talking about the hard speed of light through fiber optic cables.
Because it physically has to travel.
Right. If you're building a high-frequency trading platform for users in Tokyo, but your infrastructure is running in New York, that physical distance creates a measurable lag.
Which is a huge deal for trading.
It's huge. At enterprise scale, 100-millisecond delay per transaction can cascade into massive system bottlenecks or just catastrophic user drop-off rates.
Which means you want to park your application in the region geographically closest to your heaviest user base.
Yes.
But the third rule, service availability, kind of throws a wrench into that, doesn't it? The notes point out that not all AWS services are available in every single region.
Right, because AWS is constantly rolling out new innovations, like specialized machine learning instance types, brand new database engines. They don't just magically manifest in every single data center worldwide on day one.
Because it's physical hardware.
Exactly. They have to stagger the rollouts. If your core application architecture relies on a highly specific, cutting-edge AI service, you have to verify that your chosen region actually has the hardware installed to support it.
And then finally, the finance team gets to look at rule four, which is pricing, because the actual cost of running this heavy industry varies wildly based on local economics.
Yeah, you're paying for local real estate, local taxes, and the local power grid. I mean, the electricity required to cool thousands of servers running at maximum capacity in a London summer is going to be priced very differently than the hydro-powered cooling you might get in a facility in the Pacific Northwest.
That makes total sense.
Those operational realities are baked directly into the pricing of each specific region.
Okay, so that gives us our macro map. We have these massive geographic regions, isolated by default, chosen through a gauntlet of compliance, latency, availability, and price. Let's zoom in a bit.
Sure.
If regions are the broader territories, what actually exists inside them? Because, you know, hardware breaks. Things always go wrong.
Hard drives corrupt, power grids fail, backhoes accidentally cut through fiber cables. It happens all the time. And that brings us to the micro view, which are availability zones, or AZs.
The documentation defines an availability zone as one or more discrete data centers with redundant power, networking, and connectivity within a region. And most regions have a minimum of three of these AZs.
The operative word there is discrete. Deploying into an availability zone means putting your infrastructure into a highly secure, specific facility or a tightly bound cluster of facilities.
So they aren't just in the same building.
No, they are physically separated from each other by miles to protect against localized failures, but they still operate within that same geographic region.
I was trying to visualize how this actually handles failures without the end user noticing.
Mm.
And the best analogy I came up with is the watertight compartments on a massive ship.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, like you don't build a ship with one giant hollow hull.
Yeah.
You divide it into independent compartments. That way, if the ship hits a reef and one compartment floods, the water is entirely contained. The ship itself, the region keeps sailing.
That is a highly accurate way to look at it, especially when you factor in the automated response. Because if that one water tank compartment floods, the system doesn't just passively stay afloat.
It does something about it.
Right. The load balancers act like a captain who instantly seals the blast doors and automatically reroutes all the passengers' your data traffic into the safe compartments before they even realize there was a leak.
So if a massive localized power outage takes down AZ number one, AZs two and three are running on entirely different substations and different floodplains,
mm-hmm.
The traffic just shifts seamlessly.
Exactly, because they maintain high-speed, ultra-low latency fiber connections between them. This allows an architect to build what the notes call a multi-AZ architecture.
Which brings me to a bit of pushback.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, I see the value of the watertight compartments, but I have three discrete, fully redundant availability zones in my region, handling all my automatic failovers. Why do I need multiple regions?
Ah.
The study materials dedicate a lot of space to multi-region deployments, but isn't that just expensive overkill if my AZs are already redundant?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you've just hit on one of the most critical conceptual divides in cloud architecture. The documentation draws a very hard line here. Multi-AZ deployments are meant for high availability. Multi-region setups are for disaster recovery.
Break the difference down for me, because those sound like the exact same thing to a layman. High availability versus disaster recovery.
Sure. So high availability is about absorbing the mundane day-to-day failures of physical hardware. You know, a generator blows a gasket, a core network switch fries, an entire availability zone goes dark.
The everyday stuff.
Exactly. Your multi-AZ architecture shifts the load, and your user doesn't even see a buffering wheel on their video stream. You contain the localized failure.
That's the day-to-day resilience. What constitutes a disaster, then?
A disaster is when the unthinkable scale of nature or human error overrides your watertight compartments. I mean, what if a Category 5 hurricane levels the infrastructure of an entire state? What if a massive earthquake destroys the underlying connectivity of the entire geographic area? It doesn't matter that your availability zones were 20 miles apart and on different power grids if the whole region is underwater.
So the entire region, all the AZs, go offline simultaneously.
Yes. And if your application is handling the electrical grid for a country or clearing billions of dollars in financial trades, you cannot afford to go offline just because a natural disaster hit Virginia.
You need a backup plan.
You need automatic failover capabilities to a completely independent region halfway across the continent or even across the globe. High availability handles the everyday bumps. Disaster recovery handles the existential threats.
And if you're listening to this and thinking, well, I just run a mid-sized e-commerce platform, I probably don't need multi-region disaster recovery, you're almost certainly right. It's about tailoring the architectural complexity to the actual stakes of your business.
Precisely. Designing for failure at two completely different scales comes with incredibly different price tags.
Right. Yeah. So we have AZs protecting data within a region and regions protecting against massive geographic disasters. But this brings up a logistical friction point. Let's go back to our engineers fighting latency.
Okay.
Say your data is sitting securely in an AZ in Tokyo. Mm. You don't need disaster recovery, so you haven't replicated it anywhere else. Mm. But a user trying to access your application is in London.
That's a long way.
Right.
Okay.
How do we solve the physics problem of that travel time without paying to replicate our entire server infrastructure all over the globe?
Enter the third major component of the physical map, edge locations.
The notes describe edge locations as data centers used by AWS CloudFront to cache content closer to end users.
Yeah, CloudFront is AWS's content delivery network.
Yeah.
And the critical mechanism here is caching.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The documentation points out that there are over 200 edge locations scattered worldwide. That vastly outnumbers the actual regions. I mean, they are in almost every major city.
Their entire architectural purpose is hyperlocal proximity.
Which led me to a pretty obvious question when reading this. If edge locations are literally everywhere, why don't we just run our core applications from them? Like skip the regions entirely.
Oh, just run it all from the edge.
Yeah. If they are closer to the users, wouldn't putting our databases in the edge locations just be inherently better?
I mean, it sounds like the perfect solution on paper, but this is a vital distinction the notes emphasize heavily. Edge locations are strictly for content delivery and caching to eliminate latency. They are absolutely not designed for running full compute resources or complex backend services.
So I can't put my heavy lifting application servers in an edge location in London.
The notes actually contain a specific warning about this. Edge locations are not for running EC2 instances, which are the virtual servers that execute the complex logic and math of your application.
They just don't have the muscle for it.
Exactly. Those heavy compute workloads live in the regions. The edge locations simply hold the static, cached copies of data to speed up delivery.
Okay, let me trace the path to make sure I understand the mechanism. My main server in the Tokyo region is doing the hard database processing. But my application is heavy. It has high-resolution images, video files, massive CSS payloads.
A lot of static data.
Right, and I don't want to drag those massive files all the way from Tokyo to London every single time a user opens the app.
The bandwidth costs alone would be astronomical, let alone the load times.
Right. So instead, the very first time a user in London requests that high-res video, it makes the long journey from Tokyo to London. But a copy of that video gets cached, saved locally, at the edge location sitting right there in London.
And then?
Then the next 10,000 users in London who want that same video pull it instantly from the facility right down their street.
You've nailed the workflow perfectly. The heavy dynamic compute stays centralized in the region. The static heavy lifting gets distributed to the edge.
It's so efficient.
It is, but it's not just basic file caching either. The documentation highlights services like Route 53 and AWS Global Accelerator, which leverage these edge locations in brilliant ways.
I noticed that, yeah. The notes describe Route 53 as global DNS, but that feels like it's underselling it.
It definitely is. Think of Route 53 less like a static phone book for internet addresses and more like a highly intelligent GPS system. It actively monitors the health of the global network in real time.
So it knows where the traffic jams are.
Exactly. If it sees that a specific path is congested, it acts as a traffic cop, instantly routing a user away from the public internet traffic jam and into the nearest healthy edge location.
And then Global Accelerator takes it a step further by pulling that user's traffic off the chaotic public internet and routing it through AWS's own private dark fiber network.
It's incredible.
It's like paying to use a private high-speed toll road while everyone else is stuck in gridlock.
It's an immense competitive advantage, and it's built purely on physical real estate. We have regions for geographic isolation and compute power, availability zones for localized fault tolerance, and edge locations acting as this massive net to catch and accelerate user requests.
It is an incredibly elegant, almost brutalist system. But, mapping out this physical infrastructure is really only half of what these source materials are trying to accomplish.
Yeah, the document actually has a fascinating meta layer to it. In the final section, it pivots completely away from hacking the global internet architecture and focuses entirely on hacking the human brain to actually retain all this complex systems design.
Which is necessary because nodding along to the concept of a multi-AZ architecture is very different from being able to design one on a whiteboard under pressure.
The author of the notes clearly understands the psychological forgetting curve. I mean, if you don't continually interrupt the brain's natural process of discarding information, these concepts just fade.
So what does this all mean? Well, the notes lay out a methodology that ties perfectly into the architecture we just discussed. They push active recall, which is essentially running a Route 53 health check on your own knowledge.
Closing the book and forcing yourself to explain it.
Yes, explaining the mechanism out loud.
Yeah.
And then there is spaced repetition. Reviewing the material on day one, day three, day seven.
Which is, if you think about it, exactly like edge caching for your brain.
Yes.
The first time you learn how an availability zone works, your brain is doing heavy compute, dragging the data all the way from Tokyo. But if you review it repeatedly, your brain caches that information locally. The recall becomes instant.
That's a phenomenal parallel. They also strongly advocate for study groups, which is essentially building a multi-AZ architecture for your learning process.
Discussing concepts with peers covers your blind spots.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If your understanding of a topic fails, your group corrects you and keeps the overall learning process highly available.
But the most crucial piece of advice is the mandate for practice, getting out of the textbook and getting hands-on in the AWS console with a free tier account.
Which makes sense. You can't just read about it.
This raises an important question about the illusion of competence. It is dangerously easy to memorize flashcards. You can easily memorize the rote definition that an AZ is a data center and a region is a cluster. But getting hands-on is the only bridge between theoretical memorization and practical structural understanding.
Because when you actually log into the console and attempt to make two isolated regions talk to each other, you hit a wall. You suddenly feel the friction of that default isolation we talked about earlier. You are forced to build the bridge yourself.
The document sums up its entire philosophy in one line: understanding beats memorization.
I love that.
When a core database cluster crashes at 2 a.m. on a Sunday, reciting the definition of an edge location won't help you recover the data. Only a deep understanding of the underlying mechanical gears will let you fix the architecture.
Well, we have covered an immense amount of physical ground today. We started by defining regions, the macro anchors that force us to navigate international law, latency, and economics.
Right, the big picture.
Then we zoomed into the availability zones, those watertight compartments giving us the high availability to survive power grids failing.
And finally, we explored the massive footprint of edge locations, utilizing caching and private fiber networks to bend the rules of latency and bring the data right to the user's doorstep.
It fundamentally changes how you look at the glass in your hand. The next time a global streaming app loads instantly on your phone, or you read the news about a massive regional power outage but notice your banking app is functioning perfectly, you now understand the exact mechanics behind the curtain.
You know the invisible, heavy-duty physical infrastructure making that illusion of magic possible.
It is arguably the most complex machine humanity has ever built.
Without a doubt.
As we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Something that builds entirely on that very first crucial detail we pulled from the architecture blueprints. The mandate that regions are fully independent and data is never replicated between them without your explicit action.
The default state is total isolation.
Right. Think about the philosophical implications of that design choice. If the default setting of the world's largest, most advanced data infrastructure is isolation and not connection, it means the cloud isn't actually inherently safe on its own.
No, it's not.
The cloud isn't some benevolent entity that is going to automatically save your business when disaster strikes. It is just a massive, incredibly powerful box of raw materials scattered across the globe.
It's up to you.
The ultimate responsibility for keeping your data secure and ensuring it survives a catastrophic failure rests entirely on the specific architectural choices that you make. You aren't just renting a server. You are the architect of your own resilience.
The materials are there, but you have to know how to forge the steel.
Exactly. Until next time, keep digging, keep questioning, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.